Good morning and welcome to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Today's date is March 24th, 2026. The first order of business, we do have a quorum, by the way, and the first order of business is approval of the minutes. Chair Mueller, would you like to approve the minutes or move the minutes?
Yes,
I'll move. Thank you.
I'll move, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. I will read our safety notice. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak to the sergeant staff wearing the gold ties. State troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given 2 minutes, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it, as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct this hearing efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. I also want to recognize in the room with us today, we have 12th grade students from Mankato East High School. Welcome to all of the students. We're glad to have you with us. All right. Our first bill this morning is House File 3951, Representative Igo. Chair Igo, please come forward. Chair Igo is not a member of this bill, so I will move House File 3951, and the motion would be to recommend that it pass and be placed on the general register. Go ahead, Rep. Igo.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's wonderful to join you here this morning in the Judiciary Committee. The bill in front of you today is a bill that I think we can all recognize as one of those good things that happens at the legislature. This is what happens when you have different groups come together and say, we have an issue we need to fix. They spend the interim working on it and then work with the legislature and bring a finished product to the table. And that's what the bill is in front of us, and it's going to be fixing sub-metered utility service for in regard to landlord-tenant law. So with me, I have Cecil Smith from Minnesota Multi-Housing and Ron Elwood, and I'm going to let them talk about the bill and the work they did over the interim, because I'm just the guy that gets to champion the good work that they did.
All right. Very good. Who's going first, Mr. Smith?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. We did indeed spend the interim working on two primary issues that were of importance to both Legal Aid and the Minnesota Multi-Housing to create a much clearer understanding of what is required on final utility billing. And when we have members of our industry who use a portal and renters use that portal to pay their rent, and when that isn't working, what is the remedy? And so both of us had a challenge there, and I am grateful to Representative Igo and Representative Howard for carrying the bill, and my colleague, Mr. Ron Elwood, who is legendary, and it is a great pleasure to work with him and to solve these kinds of problems on behalf of both renters and housing providers.
All right, thank you. Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I just want to thank Representative Igo, Chair Igo, and Mr. Smith and the Multi-Housing Association. This is a really, as Chair Igo said, this is a really good example of finding common ground in areas that of mutual interest. And I think this is a good model for the way we should be doing things around here. And, this does solve. We came to Multi-Housing Association with a problem that our clients were seeing, And they came to us with a problem that their members were seeing. And as we always do, we sit down and talk about it. It took a long time to get to where we are, but we got the right language. And we're happy to answer any questions about the specifics, but we really appreciate your support today.
Thank you both for being here. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for bringing this bill. Anything having to do with sub-metering utilities, I know, is like really important and complicated. And I'm glad students are here to see this, because this probably won't be like the headline in the Star Tribune. It'll be something about all of us yelling at each other. But this is just good governance, and I'm grateful for all of the work that was done to bring it here. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member discussion? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3951 be passed and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to the GR. Thank you, Chair Igo.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 4005, Representative Warwas. Welcome to the committee. We are glad to have you with us.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Cal Warwas of the Iron Range, District 7B, Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for hearing our bill today. Before we get started, since I'm new here, I did bring treats, so I don't know if that's the rule here, but I just made sure of it. So
it's not the rule, but we do applaud you.
Well, thank you for that. So I've got cookies from the Don Pancho's Bakery from down the street where I live when I'm in town. So the pages are going to pass those out for you.
All right. We are always appreciative of food. So thank you, Representative Warwas. And the motion here with your bill, I will move the bill, House File 4005. The motion here is to lay the bill over. And with that, why don't you tell us about your bill? And then I know you brought a testifier with you.
Yes, thank you so much for that. This bill really is discussing biometric data and how it is stored and who can access it. County workers in my area, I mean, the bill is written more broadly, but county workers in my area have discovered that their data is recorded, like when they're driving heavy equipment, like especially plow trucks. And I'll let my testifier, Jake Lazer, explain that, but you just want to make sure that we are utilizing people's data properly so that they're not being exposed in ways they shouldn't be.
Excuse me. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jacob Glauser. I'm a Teamster Steward with Local 320 in St. Louis County, and I'm constituent of Representative Warwas. I'm here to testify on behalf of my local union for this bill, which I initiated. A little over 2 years ago, management installed a test program which included forward and driver-facing cameras into our county plow trucks. These cameras were installed and activated by me at their direction. No mention of the true capabilities were explained to our workforce at that time. We had run into some problems with them, and a representative from the company came out to help me. It was only then that I learned the true AI and biometric.
Closer to the mic. Thank you.
Yep. Sorry about that. It was only then that I learned the true AI and biometric capabilities of this process. They use AI to monitor driver movement and distractions and driving behavior. The camera uses a biometric facial recognition measurements to identify the driver of that truck. This was concerning to me, knowing the Freedom of Information Act affords the release of this information to anyone for a nominal fee. In addition to that, within our organization, we had at least two unauthorized viewings of at least two operators in cab footage. When we blew the whistle on this, our representative employees lost access to the data. I knew how sensitive and dangerous improper storage and use of biometric identification data could be, and as a steward, I began working on contract language to protect my bargaining unit. The deeper I dug into this, I found more contracts and laws on the books in other states protecting citizens from this very thing. The scope and measure of what I am hoping to achieve is not to eliminate the use of these cameras or AI, but to regulate the storage of the data. I feel biometric identifiers are as personal as a social security number and should be treated with such care. These are used down to the simplest items we all have in our room today, our cell phones. When you use your face to unlock your phone, that is a simple act of biometric identification. When this data is stored in video files, it can easily be accessed for malicious intent. We need these rules in place to regulate the data, the duration this data is stored and who has access to it. We need to safeguard this sensitive data while it is needed and then delete it at the appropriate time for a professional and our security workforces, as well as the general public. And I'm happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
I can't remember to turn my mic on today. Thank you for coming all the way down to testify today and tell us your story. Next on the agenda, or next testified, Mr. Beeler. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Morning, Chair Scott, members of the committee. My name is John Beeler. I'm the policy counsel with the ACLU of Minnesota, and we are testifying today in support of HF 4005, Regulating and Safeguarding Minnesotans' Biometric Data. Laws like this are unfortunately rare at the state level, but they have been passed in red and blue states such as Illinois, Texas, Washington, Nebraska, Vermont, and Colorado. Illinois passed their law in 2008, and the ACLU provided briefing in support of an unsuccessful 2018 challenge to invalidate the law. Illinois' reasoning is similar here, that biometric information is biologically unique to the individual, and once compromised, the individual has no recourse, is at heightened risk for identity theft, and likely to withdraw from biometric facilitated transactions. Unlike license plate numbers, passwords, ID cards, even social security numbers, biometric identifiers cannot be changed in the wake of unauthorized disclosure or misuse. Can't change your fingerprints, can't change your retinal scans, can't change your DNA. In many cases, this information cannot be protected and concealed against unauthorized acquisition in the first instance because our faces, our eyes, and our voices are routinely and unavoidably exposed to public view. With the advent in technology and the growing use of this technology, it's becoming more worrisome. We've got citations in that brief to how that testimony is being used, how that data is being collected. Retinal scans are now possible from up to 12 feet away. Facial identifiers can be scanned up to 2,500 points on a face, and a lot of that is being done without knowledge. We've seen it being used in retail stores to track shoppers, employees collecting biometrics for time tracking and attendance management, banks, churches, schools, to allow access and to regulate use. So without limitations and restrictions like those provided for in this bill, biometric technologies threaten to enable corporations to pervasively track people's movements and activities in public and private spaces, and they risk exposing people to forms of identity theft that are particularly hard to remedy. We want to thank Representative Warwas and the Teamsters for bringing this bill forward, and we urge the committee to support HF 4005. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for or against this bill? If not, we will move to member questions. All right. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Warbus, for your bill. I don't know if this is a question for you or for nonpartisan, or I'm just curious how we are defining a person in this bill. We heard about retailers. Is that employers? Is that just people in the public? I always want to make sure I understand.
Representative Warbus, would you like to answer that, or would you like House Research to tackle that?
Yeah, I'd like to see what House Research has to say about it, actually. Thank you for the question.
Perfect. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so under Section 645.44, which deals with the definitions of words and phrases throughout Minnesota statute, person can extend and be applied to bodies politic and corporate and to partnerships and unincorporated associations. So it includes natural persons, i.e. individuals, human beings, as well as corporate persons and other kinds of business entities.
Thank you. Representative Finke?
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up then. Does that, when we say corporate, does that include governments? Does it include agencies? Does it include law enforcement agencies? Does it include nonprofits? Like, how do we, what kind of, not to go down the rabbit hole here, but
okay,
how are we defining corporate?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, so it's the most inclusive definition. So it would include bodies politic, so it would, units of government, mm-hmm. Nonprofit organizations, business entities, partnerships, et cetera.
Representative Finke.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it very much, Mr. Hopkins, and appreciate the bill.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question for the bill author, because I see this has an exception for federal purposes, and I'm just curious if you know how it is being used federally and what those exceptions might be.
Representative Warwas.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. Offhand, I do not know that answer, but I think, Jake, if you want to take a...
I don't have the exact law in front of me, but there is federal law on the books regarding body camera footage and biometrics for government agencies at the federal level currently.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do support the bill. I just have to flag that concern because we have seen federal agents taking images of individuals, scanning their faces, constitutional observers and others. Apparently, there's some database, Palantir is a corporation that's helping with all of this technology, and it's just really alarming to me what might be happening there, which I know isn't addressed in this bill. I just needed to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Warwas. Appreciate the treats. I'm glad this bill's being laid over. I think that there might be other stakeholders and perspectives that might need to take a look at the potential unintended consequences of some of the language. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to give us a little bit of a sense of where you're coming at this philosophically, because we have a lot of technological developments that are moving forward very rapidly, and this is one of them. At the same time, as those developments occur, the question becomes, well, how do we apply previous precedents to the new technology? So in this case, do you really have an expectation of privacy when you're out and about in public or at your job? What's the difference between facial recognition data and a simple photograph, which in essence is biometric data? It's how you recognize a person as who they say they are, that we each have a driver's license in our pocket. What's kind of in your mind the red line past which this becomes a concern that requires legislation?
Representative Warwas.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for that question. You know, I was talking to a friend earlier, and they pointed out that, you know, technology is way, way ahead of government. And so, you know, part of this is obviously for concerns that my constituent brought forward, but part of it is just a conversation starter, because I recognize there's a lot of concerns around everything that you just stated, really, but like what constitutes a photo, what do we have an expectation of privacy? I think all of those things are important. So I appreciate your comments, actually, about this needing more work and more conversations. Actually, I couldn't believe how much response we got bringing this bill forward. It started out as something that we would try to utilize to protect Teamster members, like at St. Louis County, and kind of exploded into a broader conversation. So I appreciate that perspective.
All right, thank you. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing the bill. I also support the concept, and I am glad that Representative Finke asked about the definition of a person, because that is exactly what I had flagged to ask. But there's another little language piece, too, in here that I just wanted to check with House Research about. It just seems like, I'm not sure we usually word things this way, but online 2.15, it says, the Attorney General may bring an action to recover the civil penalty. And I don't know if that is the usual way we give the Attorney General authority to enforce. It's just saying they can recover the civil penalty. Mr. Hopkins, I don't know if you can just give me a little comfort on that. I'm just not sure why it's stated that way.
Mr. Hopkins.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, so I think the intent here is to give the Attorney General enforcement authority over this section and the ability to recover that civil penalty, which is $25,000 for each violation. Since the bill is being laid over, we could work on the enforcement language to tailor it more.
Yeah.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, make sure that it was written correctly, and just struck me as not what I usually see. I commend you for bringing this. I think it's, really important. And I just wanted to respond to the comment that technology is ahead of government. And that's almost like baked into government. Government's kind of designed to move slowly. The legislative process is kind of designed to be deliberative, right?
Yes.
Not all, it isn't always, but it's designed to be that way, whereas tech just goes and goes and goes. And so it's a really interesting observation. We are kind of outmatched in that respect, and so trying to think ahead is really important. So thank you.
Thank you. Any final words, Representative Warwas?
I just appreciate everyone's time today. Chairs, thank you for listening to us today and the committee members. Thank you for the great questions as well. I hope you do enjoy the treats. Share them with your friends if there's any left. And we'll talk again. Happy to work with anyone on this bill and its development.
Thank you, Representative. House File 4005 is laid over. Thank you so much. Next on the agenda is House File 4585. Representative Myers is in the room. All right, more cookies, all right.
you won't need lunch.
Sugar high here. Yeah. Welcome, Representative Myers, to Judiciary and Civil Law, and thank you for sharing some sugar with us. We're very appreciative of that. Since you're not on the committee, I will move House File 4585, and the motion is that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. Go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Chair Liebling. House File 4585 improves safety for petitioners seeking restraining orders to allow them upon request to receive advance notice before a respondent is served. This bill helps individuals prepare for the moment when an order is delivered, oftentimes when risk can be at its highest, and supports proactive safety planning. By requiring law enforcement to make reasonable efforts to notify the petitioner at least 24 hours before service, using practical methods like calling, texting, emailing, the bill strengthens transparency, coordination, and personal safety without creating unnecessary burdens. I think this is a thoughtful step forward to making Minnesota's harassment restraining order process more responsive to the needs of the victims. And I do have a testifier.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dominique, and I'm keeping my last name private due to the sensitive nature of my testimony. I was invited here to share my experience, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on why this bill is important to survivors of harassment. One Monday morning in late 2024, I logged onto my work computer and saw a collection of emails from an unfamiliar name. At first glance, I thought these emails were AI spam, but as I began to read them, I realized that they were deeply personal emails that included information on my family, my work experience, my name, and my ancestry. The aggressor, a Minnesota resident, had found me on LinkedIn and singled me out as one of a few women with my specific job experience to help him be able to build a secret society. His emails were thousands of words, over 80 photo attachments, and videos of himself. One of the attachments included a photo of me with my child alongside a similar photo of him with a baby. And others included photos of himself at important places in my life, like the church where I was married and the college that I graduated from. Most concerningly, he made references to my infant son and claimed that he had a crib and a baby carriage at his home prepared for my son. In one of the videos, he discussed that he had two women picked out to offer my husband in exchange for me. I continued to receive additional concerning emails after this, so I filed a restraining order. After my harassment restraining order was granted, I quickly called the courts and eventually law enforcement to find out when my aggressor would be served. It was a Friday, and notification of service does not occur over the weekend. I was very concerned about retaliation from this individual who implied in his emails that he knew where I lived. I told law enforcement that I wanted to stay somewhere else for a period of time after he was served to keep my family safe. I was told that they would not have enough time to serve him that day and that it might happen over the weekend or early in the next week. I pleaded with someone at the office to be informed of when he would be served, and she said while this wasn't their typical protocol, she would give me a special phone number and that I would be notified over the weekend. I called each day and never received a return call. Then, after the weekend was over, I was notified that he was, in fact, served early Friday evening. While I was relieved that my family was safe, I burst into tears knowing that I had put myself, and most importantly my children, in danger by staying in our home. I felt immense guilt that I had put my children in harm's path. The passage of this bill is important to me because it would allow victims the notice and opportunity to protect themselves and their families during the service of a harassment restraining order. I know firsthand that petitioners spend immense time deciding whether filing a harassment restraining order is the safest option for themselves and their families, knowing that it could open them up to escalation and retaliation. With the passage of this bill, victims would have the opportunity to have a support person stay with them, to leave locations where their aggressor would be able to locate them, or to arrange mental support services necessary during the sensitive time while their aggressor is served. The CDC reports that over 40% of restraining orders are violated, with some outside estimates as high as 70%. Victims deserve the time and knowledge necessary to plan and protect themselves from retaliation and additional abuse. This bill would provide comfort to victims already experiencing a terrible time in their lives. Thank you for listening to my story in support of this bill.
Thank you so much for being here and for your testimony, and thank you for being proactive to try to do something to help others in the future with this issue. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony. I'm really sorry that happened to you, but appreciate your courage in being here today, and to Rep. Myers for bringing this bill. I just had a quick question. I'm curious if this is true for orders for protection. I should know the answer to this, but maybe nonpartisan staff know. Otherwise, oh, Mr. Johnson's getting up.
Go ahead, Representative Chair Moeller.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just curious if there's a similar notice requirement for orders for protection for victims.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Moeller, let me check quickly, but I believe that the answer is no. The order for protection notification requirements are modeled very closely on the harassment restraining order requirements, and I believe that they are effectively identical. Madam Chair, Representative Moeller, I can confirm the notice requirements that are in the Order for Protection statute, which is 609.748, are related to providing notice about the hearings and those sorts of things, but not about service.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it sounds like this is coming to public safety, so it might be something you want to match that up and require it for orders for protection as well. So we can talk about that as the bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Representative Steer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and we can add in HRO to that as well. And then I would encourage you to work with the chiefs, the sheriffs, MPPOA, and LELS, and get some support with them. The 24-hour notification may need to be tweaked a little bit. It's just sometimes you don't have that amount of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Steer, for that. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, well, thank you. I add my thanks for your being here and bringing us your situation, and Representative Myers for bringing the bill. I'm glad this is going to public safety, because the only real concerns I had about it were kind of how it works for the agencies. But another question just occurred to me, and I kind of hate to ask this, but does this impose liability upon the local law enforcement if they fail to do this? That wouldn't be a deal killer for me, but I'm just really think we should understand. Maybe Mr. Johnson can opine on that, how that works with, you know, if this goes into law and then somebody fails to do it and there's a terrible result because of that failure, I just wonder what happens then.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, this bill is silent on whether it creates any additional liability, so this would fall under sort of the standard liability. In general, when an act is discretionary or not, it's not a ministerial act. There is immunity that would apply to the state actors, but this particular provision does not explicitly address that.
Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, that's just something to consider, Representative. I don't know what to recommend there. I don't know what I would want to see, but I just think it's something that as a legislature, we probably better understand that as we're passing it. So thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's, you know, hopefully this hearing has been really helpful to you as you move to public safety. I think this is a really, I'm so thankful for Dominique bringing this story to us and that this affects a lot of people. And so I think it's, the intentions are all there. I think it's a good idea. It's just it needs maybe some tweaking, and hopefully public safety, you can get some of these questions answered and issues resolved. So thank you for bringing the bill. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 4585 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to public safety. Thank you so much. The next bill on our agenda is House File 962, Novotny. Chair Novotny, welcome to the committee. Members, the motion on this bill is to lay the bill over. And Chair Novotny, I will, well, why don't you tell us about your bill, House File 962.
Thank you for hearing the bill, Chair Scott and Chair Liebling. Bill 962 is a bill that I've been working on for several sessions to make sure the citizens of the state can trust law enforcement while they have the same protection, the right to the peace officers in fair and uniformed enforcement. I have with me Brad Johnson, Anoka County Attorney, representing the State County Attorneys Association, who explained the work that has been done so far by the stakeholder group. Earlier this week, the judiciary weighed in and declared that there would be a fiscal cost to the courts. I do understand that there will be additional courts cost by one of the lines. The DE that we are working on today, DE4, is not perfect. It is the latest work that has been done by the stakeholder group, but it, to borrow a term from Mr. Titus from the MPPOA, we are not at the finish line yet. With that, I will turn it over to County Attorney Johnson, who can explain where the stakeholder group is at right now. And I do have the other stakeholder some of the stakeholder representatives here from the chiefs and the MPPOA, but in the interest of saving community time, we'll have them available for questions if you need them, and we'll lay this over.
Chair Novotny, before we move to Mr. Johnson's testimony, let's move the DE4 and get that before us. I will move the DE4 to House File 962. Is there any discussion on the DE4? Seeing none, all those in favor of passage of the DE4, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The DE4 is adopted. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Co-chair, members, may it please the committee. My name is Brad Johnson. I'm the Anoka County Attorney. I'm also a member of the board in the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I'm the leader of the work group that has been comprised of suburban, rural, and urban county attorneys to discuss this Brady-Giglio issue and access to data, which is part of the bill that appears before you. As you heard, we've been working with law enforcement stakeholders and reached out to others as well on this. I think of particular importance for this committee is the addition of Subdivision 4 starting at line 3.17. So if you all have it in front of you, if you could take a look at that. That is a pivotal part for the county attorneys because it allows data access by the prosecuting authority with a written policy and outlines when access shall be allowed by the employer. There is also an addition at subdivision 4B, line 3.29, that includes a process for resolving any disputes regarding data access. We view this as being, the way we've described it in our back and forth and in our own workforce is, we want to see if we can resolve access to 90%+ of the situations that might involve a Brady-Giglio determination. We anticipate there may be some limited times where we have a dispute that we need to sort out, and so there needs to be a court process for that. Finally, there's new language in subdivision 5B that deals with destroying materials when a prosecutor determines that Brady-Giglio material is no longer relevant in any future criminal proceeding. So if somebody has, for example, passed away, is no longer employed or could ever be a witness, then the need for a prosecuting authority to maintain that, that material would then dissipate and go away. The addition of the data access is a top priority for prosecutors because courts are holding them responsible for having or imputing to them knowledge of all public and private information related to actions of potential Brady-Giglio material. And the dispute resolution language and language to destroy material no longer relevant was important to law enforcement. In all, now this bill provides that all prosecuting authorities shall implement a written policy, so that's number one. Can't create a blanket prohibition list or scarlet letter on law enforcement officers. That's number two. May access all relevant data to make their Brady-Giglio determinations and to meet their Brady-Giglio obligations, and provides for important notice to employers and employees. That is essentially where we are at today. I will say the County Attorneys Association board met on Friday. The County Attorneys Association would support this bill so long as it has the access provision and is agreeable to a limited review by the district court if there's a dispute or an objection by a public employer. Thank you. I stand ready for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for being here and for your testimony. I have another testifier on the bill, Tori Key. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Tori Key. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and on behalf of our 842 members, thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 962. We appreciate all of the work that's gone into this. We know that balancing policies that impact the public, prosecuting agencies, and individual data privacy is tough work. However, there are still several provisions in the DE4 that gives some rise to concern. First is subdivision 3, the do not call list. We understand where the language comes from and the purpose of it, and we found that the first sentence where it calls for the disclosure of information to be made on a case-by-case basis, we approve of that, and we think that further along in the subdivision there, that language could create a confusing policy that could concern employment matters, collective bargaining agreements, and just overall create some confusion among employers and employees. So that language in that first sentence from 3.73 through 3.10, we believe would be sufficient to ensure that these matters are being considered on a case-by-case basis and hopefully prevent some of the concern by the officers. Further, subdivision 4, as the county attorney was speaking, data is a top priority for cities as well. We're in a unique position as both the responsible authority, as a government entity, the employer of folks who are that this policy would deal with, and then as well as the public who might be requesting data generally. And there just seems to be a lot of duplications for the protections and remedies that are available under Chapter 13, and it may also cause some conflicts. So, for example, Subdivision A says that data maintains its classification. So it could be a mixed classification data, public personnel records and non-public personnel records, maybe some classified stuff. But then the subsequent provisions require, protections from disclosure and could create some conflicts with the obligations to disclose public data. Or the subdivision, I don't know exactly which section it was, where the individual to protect data is a very vague term. And the provision that would enact a misdemeanor offense for the recipient of data giving out data incorrectly could cause confusion if that is actually public data already. It could be confusing whether or not that data that's public could be shared or not. So overall, codification of these fundamental rights do warrant a really deep and structured evaluation and study. We just are concerned that the DE4 leaves open some possible conflicts and confusions, especially as it relates to the Data Practices Act for government personnel data. And for these reasons, we can't support the current proposal. But we appreciate the author's work and everyone's work on this and look forward to aiding and adding any input we can to help get it to where it needs to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Key, for putting your concerns on the record. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill or express concerns with it? All right. Seeing none, member questions. Oh, I didn't know that the smile at the chair was just your indication that you wanted to talk, but I was just smiling back. I don't know. Chair Moeller.
Thank you. It's better than when I looked perplexed before in committee. Glad to have a smile on my face. I, too, want to thank the stakeholders, Chair Novotny, for your continued work on this. I know a lot's gone into this. When this bill left the Public Safety Committee, we passed it through so that work could continue. We did have a lot of questions about other stakeholders that may or may not have been engaged. I appreciate the League coming forward and sharing their concerns. Other stakeholders that we asked about were the defense bar, also because this is pretty broadly impacting public employees, AFSCME or MAPE, because obviously a lot of those employees testify in various cases. So I'm just curious what other stakeholder engagement has happened.
So a couple of things.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Chair members, a couple of things on the stakeholder engagement. Following the Public Safety Committee meeting, I know that Bob Small of the County Attorneys Association reached out to Bill Ward at the Public Defender's Office and spoke with him about it. My understanding of that is that the Public Defender recognizes that this is a prosecution function, is aware of the bill, will review any amendments that we make to it and provide us with any input that he has so that we may consider that and carry that forward as a part of it. To date, there hasn't been any constructive suggestions that have come from the public defender on that. With respect to others, I want to make sure that everybody understands that this bill is limited in scope temporally. This is the bill that allows two governmental agencies, prosecution authority, whether that be a city attorney or a county attorney, to work with a law enforcement agency, whether that be at the state level, the county level, or the city level, to share information and to access information among each other. So there are still ongoing discussions. I would note that the League was invited to participate and weigh into the work group work that we have going all the way back to last fall. So it's hard to get some of this input right now, but we will certainly work with everybody on getting input that they may have to this bill. So,
Chair
thank
Mueller.
You.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I certainly understand what the bill is trying to do here, but it's also sharing public employee information as well. And so, again, I will say that I think AFSCME and MAPE should be consulted. I did get an email from a public defender who lives in my district and has concerns. I did encourage him to reach out. I don't think he ever did. And so just want to flag that as well. But I really think you do need to reach out to AFSCME and MAPE. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member concerns? Chair or Representative Steer.
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like we're going to kick the Brady Giglio law or bill down the road again, which is disappointing. So can you please explain this fiscal note that we have and what's the finances going to, or what do we need to pay for?
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moll. Chair Scott.
Wrong committee.
What did he say?
Line 4.26 of the DE4. The district court may appoint standby legal counsel to handle any Brady Giglio material, and that's where the additional cost is coming in with the possibility of additional cost.
Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the way that I look at it, this would reduce the cost if we streamline the process. I'm trying to figure out how is this going to add extra cost?
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Representative Steer. I understand what you're saying, that, you know, the overall process, once it's streamlined, should reduce cost, but the feeling of the court system and judiciary was that having to appoint standby legal counsel might have a cost. Actually, their workload might go down, but if they have to hire someone in a position to act in that role, that there might be cost with that.
Chair Steer, yeah, or not Chair
I'm the
Steer,
question, another Steer. Chair. I'm disappointed that Brady Giglio is going to get kicked down the road again, and we're going to deal with this next session. So it's disappointing.
Well, the bill, Representative Steer, the bill is not dead. Let's just say nothing around here is ever really fully dead. It's only maybe mostly dead. Like on Princess Bride, you know, so. One of my favorite sayings of all time, he's only mostly dead. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel like I should have a Princess Bride reference, but I can't. I have an inconceivable. Okay.
Yes.
I was just thinking about the change of circumstances, and I'm just thinking out loud as I'm thinking about what this would mean, and I don't quite understand it. So the change in circumstances relating to a specific criminal proceeding, I don't know how that misconduct in that specific context becomes less relevant to someone's credibility in a future proceeding, just because maybe the parties related to that specific incident may have passed away or that issue's been resolved. So I'm just curious if you could clarify.
Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Representative Feist, Chair, members. What I think is contemplated in that is that Brady Giglio only really, it's a trial right, so it only really gets invoked when there's a potential witness that's going to hit a witness stand. And so as a result of that, if the person is never conceivably going to be a witness again in a criminal case, what basis or reason would there be for a prosecuting authority to retain that evidence or that information?
Representative Feist.
Great. Thank you. You know, I think there might be something that I've never quite understood, and mm-hmm. maybe other people don't understand it either, so I'll just ask. So I guess my understanding of the Brady Giglio list was that it was broader than specific to a specific individual, and that it was about misconduct that could reflect more broadly on someone's credibility on the stand. And so if I understand correctly, then it only ever relates to the specific person that was involved in the specific incident that led them to be on the list. Like, I thought the issue is that people stayed on the list forever once they were on the list.
So,
yeah. Mr. Johnson.
If I may, Representative Vice Chair, members, the information that relates to a Brady Giglio event, if you will, only is information that can be used for impeachment purposes of a specific individual. So it's not broader than that. And the disclosure obligation is only triggered in a criminal proceeding if that person is a potential witness or a material witness in the case. Beyond that, there's no purpose for the prosecuting authority to have access to information, especially private or non-public information, which some Brady Giglio material is private and non-public information. Some of it could be public if there's been discipline that's been imposed and it becomes public discipline. But in those situations, we would never even seek or request Brady Giglio material because the issue would never become germane in a criminal case. So then at that point in time, there would be no basis for a prosecuting authority to kind of hold a record of somebody who will never again be a witness. And there is no potential for it.
Representative Feist? Okay, thank you.
Happy to talk offline, too.
Any other member questions? Oh, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And I also had kind of flagged that, Representative Feist. So thanks for asking that question. And I guess I just want to ask one more thing about that. Like, so this would never be relevant, say, if there was going to be some kind of post-conviction proceeding where, where there wouldn't be an actual trial any longer, but there might be some examination of evidence, something newly comes to light. So nothing on appeal and nothing in a post-conviction where this, I'm looking at the same line that I think Representative Feist was flagging on 4.11.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, in many situations it could be relevant if somebody had been a particular witness in a particular case. It could be relevant, and that might be a basis for the prosecuting authority to then exercise their discretion to maintain that information. This does leave with the prosecuting authority the ability to exercise that discretion when appropriate.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. So it does give me a little bit of pause, you know, knowing I don't fully understand this issue, but,
sure.
If someone's in prison, they could conceivably be doing a post-conviction a long time after their trial.
Yeah.
So that just concerns me a bit that there might be a decision to destroy that. Another question I have is on line 3.19, where it talks about that the prosecuting authority would have limited access to personnel data. What does it mean to have limited access to it, including private and not public data? I mean, in what way is it limited?
Mr. Johnson.
Representative Chair, members, the idea and the concept of limited access in there is that our access to the personnel files, especially as it may relate to private and non-public data, which is at the end of that sentence there, is always limited to our Brady Giglio function in a case. We only get access to that information because we have a criminal proceeding and because we are seeking that information to fulfill our Brady Giglio obligation. So that's why it would be limited in scope and purpose for that.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you for that. I just wonder if that maybe, as you continue to work on this, whether that needs further definition. I don't want to spend any more time on it here, but thanks for your work on this. Representative Novotny, I think it does need some further work, but, you know, appreciate your continued attention to this and hope we can get it right.
Any final words, Chair Novotny?
Yes, thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Liebling, I think just to clarify what some of that information would be is that it wouldn't get access to an entire case file. We wouldn't want them to know the references that were used or their relatives' addresses and phone numbers that were, you know, as part of a hiring package or anything like that. So that's why I want to keep it limited to the scope of the Brady Giglio inquiry. With that, thank you for the time today, and we will continue to try to make this better. And since I see most of you in other committees, please feel free to make recommendations so we can get this tuned in. And to quote my favorite line from Monty Python, it's not dead yet.
That's right.
As the one who looks like Vizini in The Princess Bride, I could probably say never get into a land war in Asia.
Yeah, there you go. Absolutely. Thank you for all the Princess Bride quotes, my favorite movie, and the most quotable movie, actually. So with that, we'll lay the bill over, and I just want to thank all the stakeholders on this. It's a complicated issue, and I know there are a lot of moving parts, so thank you for all your work on it, and look forward to having it back someday, hopefully, with
thank you.
Peace in the Valley. All right, the next bill on the agenda, Representative Curran, House File 3870. Representative Curran, would you like to move House File 3870? And the motion would be that it be passed and re-referred to public safety.
Thank you, Chair. That is my motion.
All right. Proceed with your bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair and committee members. House File 3870 is a Department of Public Safety, Office of Justice Programs policy bill. It clarifies that research data on individuals are private. And with that, I believe we have an amendment. Do we want to move that amendment?
Yes. Representative Curran, I'll go ahead and move the A2. And if you want to speak to it, go ahead.
Yeah, just real quick, the amendment narrows the scope of some of the data that we're talking about and puts us in alignment with some work that the Senate has been doing.
Perfect. Thank you, Representative Curran. And I appreciate this amendment just narrowing down the data sets that you're after in this bill. Any further discussion on the A2? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. Representative Curran, do you have... we have someone signed up to testify, Kim Babin. I'm really guessing.
No problem, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. Kim Babine, long A.
Okay.
Happy to go into the bill in more detail or be available to answer questions.
Okay. Why don't you go into a little more detail? Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's a thick bill. It's thicker-ish.
Yes. Yep. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, Kim Babine. I'm Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs at the Department of Public Safety. This bill presents two data-related components and one terminology cleanup provision. The first item is related to research that's conducted by the Office of Justice Programs. It would amend Chapter 13 to include a data privacy provision for data on individuals that is created, collected, received, used, stored, or maintained by the Office of Justice Programs for the purposes of research that we conduct. The Office of Justice Programs engages in research efforts, including program evaluation, that may involve collection of quantitative and qualitative identifiable data on research participants. The second item is related to the work of the First in the Nation offices of missing and murdered Black women and girls and missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. This bill establishes the case support work provided by the offices as duties of the offices in their authorizing statutes and classifies case support data as private data on individuals. Data collected by these offices can be highly sensitive and could cause harm if made public, eroding trust between the offices and communities. The third item is more technical in nature and probably the cause of the additional pages. It updates terminology by removing or replacing references to battered women and makes changes related, those references to battered women and updates that language. That concludes my overview. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Babine. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill? Seeing no movement towards the table, we will move to member questions. All right, seeing no member questions, Representative Curran, final words.
I appreciate your time and the committee's support as we move it forward. Thank you.
With that, all those in favor of, I'll renew my motion that House File 3870 be as amended, yes. Be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Curran. The next bill that we have, Representative Schumacher, are you in the room? There he is, Chair Schumacher. All right, we have a co-presentation, the first of a couple of those we're going to have here in this committee today. Chair Schumacher, it is so good to see you again. We're so happy that in all your years here, this is only the second time you've been before this committee, and we were here to be part of this history. So thank you for being here. And Representative Curran, would you like to move, House File 4542, and the motion would be to lay it over. Is that your motion to lay it over?
Chair, that is my motion.
Thank you. Which one of you is going to tell us about the bill? All right. Chair Schumacher, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I bet you're surprised to see me co-authoring a bill for sheriff's foreclosure sales this morning because it has nothing to do with nursing homes. But as my talking points tell me, alas, I'm a man of many talents and interests. So I'm here today with this bill, and while it is lengthy or thick, as the chair had pointed out in the last bill, it's a simple fix to modernize sheriff foreclosure sales. It does two primary things, allowing mortgage foreclosure sales to be conducted online and allows the lender to appoint a private selling officer to conduct the sale. And with that, I will turn it over to Representative Curran.
Representative Curran, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to Chair Schumacher and your trapper keeper today. Good morning, chairs and members. The author's amendment labeled A1. If we could move that.
All right. The A1 is before us. Any discussion? All those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. Go ahead, Representative Kerr.
Thank you, Chair. The A1 that we just adopted was worked on with legal aid to get Peace in the Valley on this bill. Thank you so much for adopting the amendment. By allowing sales to be conducted online, more bidders are able to access these sales. Foreclosed homes are turned over faster and surpluses increase. The stakeholders have been very involved in the proposal. All have indicated that they are neutral on the bill. That includes the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Land Title Association, the Bankers Association, Minnesota State Bar Association, and Legal Aid with the amendment that we adopted. Minnesota would not be alone in passing legislation like this. It's been passed in Ohio, Illinois, Louisiana, Florida, Tennessee, Wisconsin, Colorado, and Oklahoma. With that, I'll turn it over to our testifier, Charlotte Young.
All right, thank you. Ms. Young, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Charlotte Young. I'm an attorney with auction.com, and I'm here in support of HF 4542, modernizing Minnesota's foreclosure sale process by authorizing online sales and the use of private selling officers. This bill is about improving outcomes without changing rights. It increases participation and competition at foreclosure sales by both permitting online foreclosure sales and adding the option to utilize a private selling officer to conduct the sale of the property. Online access to foreclosure auctions removes geographical and logistical barriers, which increases competitive bidding. Competitive bidding leads to higher sale prices, which in turn increase surplus funds back to the homeowners. Online bidding opens access to these sales to more local community developers who purchase while maintaining the ability to participate on equal footing with larger bidders without sacrificing transparency, local knowledge, or community involvement. Increasing bidder reach also helps reduce neighborhood blight. When properties sell more efficiently and closer to market value, we reduce the number of properties that sit vacant or revert back to the lender by default. Faster, more competitive sales means properties return to productive use sooner, benefiting communities, local tax bases, and public safety. This bill also allows a mortgagee at its discretion to appoint a licensed real estate professional or auctioneer to conduct the sale while keeping the rest of the foreclosure process firmly under sheriff's control. The private selling officer's role is limited to conducting the sale itself. All other statutory duties, including record keeping, handling sale proceeds, issuing certificates, and administering redemption, remain with the sheriff. Private selling officers add flexibility and expertise to the auction process, thereby increasing participation and competition in foreclosure sales, which helps return properties to productive use and produce higher sale results and prices that benefit debtors through increased surplus funds. The bill is intended to build on the existing framework by equipping sheriffs with additional tools, reducing administrative burden, and allowing for flexibility where beneficial, without requiring any change to the pre- or post-sale processes or removing authority from the sheriff's office. HF 4542 is balanced and carefully drafted with the support of industry participants. At the same time, debtor protections and notice requirements remain unchanged, and the sheriff's central role and oversight are fully preserved through an optional, limited modernization of the foreclosure sale process. For these reasons, I respectfully ask for your support. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Young. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Appreciate this bill. I think it makes a lot of sense. I'm in the real estate business, and a question I have is the sheriff's they can use multiple agencies, multiple people to conduct the sale. That's correct. And where they negotiate the price, how does that work?
Who's the question to? The bill's author? Or?
I'll do the testifier.
The testifier, Ms. Young.
Are you asking with regards to online sales or with the private selling officer?
Yeah, well, if you're doing an online sale or either way.
A private selling officer would be appointed by the mortgagee, and there is a provision in the bill that allows the mortgagee to select a private selling officer. That would be with them, so they would facilitate that process. For an online sale, there would be the opportunity for the sheriffs to work with a vendor to conduct the sale online, or they can keep it in-house if they so wish.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
And so the sheriff's department, then they kind of negotiate the fee, or is there kind of a standard fee, or can you give a little clarity to that?
Yes, ma'am. In the bill, there is a fee cap at $350. So they would be able to negotiate with a vendor the fee capped at $350.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah. Chair Liebling.
Thanks. I'm interested to hear that the Sheriff's Association is neutral on the bill, but so right now, my understanding of Minnesota, right now we don't do these online sales, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
But has the Sheriff's Association ever, maybe this is more to the authors, have they ever indicated an interest in having that ability? I mean, is this coming from anybody other than auction.com? Is it coming from the sheriffs? Is it coming from the counties?
To the bill's authors.
As far as I know, I have not been, I personally haven't been reached out to by any sheriffs, anyone in the Sheriff's Association. to my understanding, that nothing with sheriff's offices and how they're conducting this right now would be forced to change in any way, shape, or form. It would be allowing additional resources to be used if they choose to handle these foreclosure sales other than just solely through the sheriff's office.
Chair Leafley.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So then it's up to the sheriff to decide if they want to use auction.com or some other vendor. I thought it was up to the bank. Maybe I misunderstood. Mm-hmm.
Or we could ask House Research?
May I?
Oh, okay, to the testifier, Ms. Young.
So there's two components to this bill. There's the private selling officer route, which is with the mortgagee, the bank, the lender, who could select to use a private selling officer for the sale. There's also the online component. So the private selling officer, the sheriff, they can both use the online component. I think your question was, has there been any interest from the sheriff's office or the sheriff's association? The idea actually came from some law firms in the area that facilitate these foreclosures. We've seen that by utilizing online platforms, that the local community developers, as we call them, the local bidders, have a better opportunity to participate. So someone that has a 9-to-5 job and can't make it to the courthouse at 10 a.m., they can facilitate their purchase through an online platform. So in other states, as was mentioned, there are online platforms that have been facilitating sales. This actually arose mostly out of the COVID era when there was social distancing and a lot of stuff moved online just to ease that process. And so that's where this mostly stems from, is that we've seen some success in other states with online sales and think that Minnesota would be a great opportunity to modernize the foreclosure sale process.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you for that. And thanks for explaining kind of the two pieces of the bill. That's really helpful. I don't know if the authors would know the answer to this, but when the sheriffs do it right now, does the sheriff's office get some compensation for doing that sale? Are they getting a fee so here's where I'm going with this. Under this bill, apparently, now instead of all these sales going through the sheriff's offices, the lender would have the option to go right to a private seller, skipping the sheriff's office for the sale portion of it. So my question is, do the sheriff's departments then lose any sort of funding stream because of that?
To either one of the bill's author or the testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will do my best on that one. There is the $350 fee cap that was addressed with Representative Van Binsbergen's question, but there is no piece in this bill that would change any other fees that may be that the sheriff may have at that in their possession already. And of course, they have the option to do this process or not in there. So if they chose to keep the fees that they may or may not be collecting, that they would still have the option to do that.
Madam
Chair Liebling.
Thank you for that. But my understanding, though, under what the testifier said, is that there's also the option for the bank, just to put it in a simple term, for the bank to choose to go right to a private seller instead of to the sheriff. So my assumption is that there's some kind of income stream that is being diverted away from the counties. I guess this is something we need to maybe understand a little bit better in the future. Another question that I have about the online piece, since Minnesota hasn't done these sales online before, is whether that opens it up to having more of these sales go to out-of-state buyers. So now if you're having an online sale, you have that, you know, we have some concern in this state, and probably around the country, about corporate entities buying up homes instead of them going to individuals, right? And I just wonder if this opens up that possibility even more by putting it online and letting somebody from who knows where go and buy up foreclosed homes. So that's a concern that I have, and that's why I am not ready to support this bill. So thank you.
You have any response to that? That's a good point.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the conversation and the concerns brought up. I had some of the same concerns, Chair Liebling, that you've brought up. It did bring me some comfort to know that the current volume or the current percentage of sales that are happening online right now, over 90% are buyers who are not purchasing and buying up all of these homes. And a lot of the people purchasing homes, over 80% are people who live within that area. And so it would be my hope that those numbers would remain or even increase. And if we allow sort of this, I see it as an accessibility into the market that may not otherwise exist, but I share and have a deep concern about corporations who are out of state, well, corporations in general, buying up much needed real estate in the state of Minnesota. And I think that conversation is one that is happening, and I'm happy to work on bills that specifically narrow residential home sales in Minnesota. And I think that is a worthy discussion in its own right. I would say this bill in particular would just focus on opening up the online sales portion. But I would agree that we need to make sure that there are some guardrails put in place should this move forward, that we're not just handing over properties to folks who aren't going to be Minnesotans living in Minnesota, right?
Okay, final words, Chair Schumacher, anything else?
Just thank the committee for their consideration and for the work that you're doing on behalf of everyone in the legislature.
Oh, you're so nice. House File 4542 is laid over. Thank you.
All right, House File 3893 is the next bill on our agenda. Chair Scott, would you like to move House File 3893 before committee and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott, you have an A3 amendment. Would you like the committee to adopt the amendment?
I do. This amendment came about from stakeholder discussions, and so it encourages adoption.
Are there any member questions on the A3 amendment? Chair Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if we could just get a little more explanation of the amendment before it's adopted.
Certainly, Chair Liebling. Chair Scott, would you like to address the amendment?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm going to have my testifier to my right give more specifics on it.
Very well. State your name for the record and offer an explanation of the A3.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Stephen Girardo, and to the amendment, the language was trying to insert information there that was going to be about trying to clarify some of the licensing boards and some of the responsibilities of other stakeholders. And actually, just this morning, we received feedback from the Board of Psychology that we're going to be speaking to them about further including some of the language that they're looking for, which is to make sure that that the large corporations are being covered by the AG's office, but individual acts of individual practitioners would be within the boards. And we're refining that language as often happens in bills.
Chair Liebling.
That's fine, Mr. Chair, thanks.
Very well. Seeing no other member discussion, we will take a voice vote on the A3. All those approving say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A3 is adopted. Chair Scott, please tell the committee about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3893 would regulate artificial intelligence from engaging in psychotherapy and counseling with human beings. Legislation has passed in Illinois, Utah, and Colorado. Similar bills are pending in many other states. The U.S. Congress seems to have little bipartisan agreement these days, but they do agree that AI being involved in mental health therapy and counseling is deeply problematic. A group of Minnesota mental health professionals have been working for many months with legislators to draft a bill that will control the use of artificial intelligence in mental health therapy settings. This therapy needs to be provided by an educated, trained, and licensed mental health professional, not a chatbot. We have all read horrifying news stories of people who have committed suicide after being encouraged to do so by the computer they have been talking with. Members, a few of these articles, I don't know if they made it into the packets or not. Okay, good. One of those, a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, recounts the tragic suicide of a man in his 30s. He was experiencing serious trouble in his marriage and, quote-unquote, fell in love with his computer. The computer urged him to commit suicide so they could be together digitally. If he had been in the care of an actual human, marriage or family therapist or psychologist or other qualified mental health provider, he might be alive today. Big Tech's answer that their systems are getting better as it learns more is not good enough. AI are supercomputers. They are not human beings who go through many years of education, thousands of hours of training, including supervised therapy, and passing rigorous and comprehensive examinations in their field. All mental health professionals licensed to perform psychotherapy have at least a master's degree, and in the case of psychologists and psychiatrists, a doctorate in psychology or medicine. I would now like to hand it over to my two experts.
We have two in-person testifiers and one via Zoom. I believe the first is Eric Mishi. Again, state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name again, Doc.
Did you say?
Mishi?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I'll go. I'll be him. Chair, good morning. My name is Eric Mishi. I'm the CEO of SAVE, Suicide Awareness, Voices of Education. We are a 36-year-old Minnesota-based national suicide prevention nonprofit. Before I go any further, I just want to remind the members and staff and those watching the committee about an important resource that is available to all of you. If you're struggling in a crisis with suicidal ideation, call 988. Feel free to text it, chat it, go online. It is a resource. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's there to help you and to help others who may be struggling. One of our responsibilities at SAVE is to advocate for policies and practices that directly impact suicide prevention. That includes supporting action when something creates risk and supporting solutions that protect people. It's why we have supported efforts to regulate social media because of the documented harms it inflicts on young people and others, and it's why we support this legislation. This bill addresses a specific and growing concern, the use of AI chatbots to engage in psychotherapy and therapeutic communication. As you know and you will hear, psychotherapy is not a casual interaction. It's a clinical practice that requires training, judgment, and accountability, and requires the ability to assess risk, respond appropriately, and intervene when necessary. AI chatbots simply cannot do that. They can generate responses, they can stimulate conversation. They are robots. They do not understand the person on the other side because they are not human. They are robots. They cannot recognize when someone is at imminent risk. They are not human. They are robots. And they cannot take action to keep someone safe. In suicide prevention, these limitations matter. When someone is experiencing suicidal thoughts, the interaction they have in that moment is not neutral. It can influence what that person does next. Allowing a machine to take on the role of a therapist introduces risk where we should be reducing it, and this bill draws a clear and appropriate line. It doesn't prohibit the use of technology. It is not anti-technology, and neither is SAVE. We want to make sure that psychotherapy and therapeutic communication remains in the hands of licensed professionals, human beings, and not robots. That is a safeguard and one that will protect both young people and adults in vulnerable moments. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will move on to Dr. Steve Gerardieu. State your name again and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. I appreciate your time. I'm against Dr. Steven Gerardo. I am the co-chair of the Minnesota Psychological Association Legislative Committee. I'm a past president. I am the federal advocacy coordinator between APA and MPA. I am also on the healthcare advisory committee of the National Small Business Association, so I do a lot with healthcare policy. I'm concerned about the way that AI has been kind of marketed as being able to have answers to everybody. And the thing is that AI, the algorithms behind it, the whole purpose of it is to get you to come back and talk to it again and monetize the conversations. It is not about trying to find solutions for an individual or to help them to change. They will use validation over and over again rather than talking about change. And it basically is designed to go further and further down the rabbit hole of where someone's going. It'll give them more and more of what they seem to be looking for. The bill seeks to regulate the AI companies, to hold them accountable for how their algorithms are used by people. And there is a great deal of misunderstanding on the part of the public about what AI actually does, including the example of the gentleman that killed himself. He believed that he could be with that AI. And this is problematic because when people have mental health symptoms, that is the worst time of their life. That is when their functioning is the least logical and they're least grounded. And that is when they're the most vulnerable. And that's where you need to have a mental health professional, not AI, that is trying to get you to keep coming back and talking with the AI to monetize that. The bill has received a lot of feedback over time, and we have just received, as I mentioned earlier, feedback from the Board of Psychology, which we're going to be seeking to integrate further into it. And we continue to add stakeholders to this process, and we hope that we can be carried forward. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a testifier joining us virtually. Are you available? There we go. Go ahead and state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Nina Linero. I am Executive Director for Illinois and the Midwest at TechNet. Thank you, chairs and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak with you today on House File 3893. TechNet supports thoughtful approaches to regulating artificial intelligence in sensitive settings like psychotherapy. We agree that strong patient protections and maintaining the central role of licensed professionals is critical. We also appreciate Representative Scott's willingness to engage with us on this issue. She has been incredibly responsive and collaborative throughout the process, And I do believe that the amendment today addresses some of the issues that I'm going to speak about. So again, thank you, Representative Scott, for that. Our comments focus on ensuring the bill is clear, workable, and does not unintentionally limit responsible supervised uses of technology. First, we recommend narrowing the definition of therapeutic communication so it clearly applies to clinical therapy services rather than potentially sweeping in general wellness or educational tools. Second, we suggest clarifying references to emotional distress by focusing more specifically on suicidal or self-harm ideation, providing clearer guidance for when safeguards should apply. Third, we encourage revisions to allow AI tools under professional supervision to support administrative functions like tracking patient progress. Without this clarity, the bill may unintentionally restrict tools that help providers deliver consistent care. Finally, we recommend clarifying that AI should not independently determine treatment decisions while still allowing it to assist in drafting routine, professionally reviewed communications. Overall, our goal is to ensure the bill provides clear, actionable standards because ambiguity can create confusion rather than compliance. Again, we've outlined these recommendations in the written testimony and submitted red lines directly with the bill author. We look forward to our continued work with Representative Scott and the bill proponents. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any public testifiers to this bill? Seeing none, we will move on to member discussion. Any members who want to? Representative Finke, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for your bill. I actually have a bill that's fairly similar to this. It's getting at the same problem, taking a little bit different approach around prohibitions on artificial intelligence and therapy. I appreciate what your testifier said. I think we spend far too much time talking about intelligence and not nearly enough time talking about artificial and the understanding that chatbots and others are not self-help tools. They are products created to make you spend as much time in them as possible. And again, if it's free, you are the product. It is just gathering your information and it does not care if you live or die. So I'm really grateful for the bill. This is something that's very important to me and I look forward to working on these issues. As we go ahead, I do have a question about the bill though. In the definitions for therapeutic services, you define religious counseling, but then religious counseling is just exempted from the whole bill in the final lines. And I'm just curious why all of that was exempted from the bill.
Chair Scott.
thanks for the question. And I think probably, I've asked both of these testifiers if they know the genesis behind that, and that neither one of them do. And I was not privy when this piece was added. I would probably venture to say, though, that they are not usually trained psychotherapists. And for that reason, that's probably the reason for the exemption. And I don't know if there's probably nobody else in the room here that's part of the coalition of folks that have been meeting even before I started meeting with them. So that's the best I can do at this point, Representative Finke.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Scott. I would appreciate more conversation about that. I know that there are distinctions between religious counseling and licensed therapeutic services. But given what is required of people with licenses and knowing that therapy is provided, I think we should be careful about not requiring those individuals, for example, to report the self-harm that they may be hearing from their chatbots. Other things that this bill requires should be required. So happy to talk more about that.
Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Chair Scott. I support this bill. I have a question about lines 3.14 to 3.17. And paragraph A there in those lines doesn't relate to AI. It relates more to advertising or offering therapy services. And it says, unless it's conducted by an individual who's a licensed professional. And then I looked at the definition of licensed professional, and it's someone with a Minnesota license. I know a couple years ago we passed where we joined the compact with other states so that people could have their therapy done by a therapist in another state online. And so I'm just curious if that this language conflicts with that compact. And then also just a concern about licensed professional. I know there are other professionals that do provide good services like menopause specialists. It's really hard to find that. You know, you're an open book when you're in the legislature, but it's very hard. It's very hard to find those services, and they're not licensed. And so I just would worry that that particular language, which really isn't addressing AI at all anyway, seems a little broad, and hope it can be narrowed.
Okay.
Thanks.
Chair Scott.
Thank you for that feedback and good points, especially on the compact. Right. We don't want to be in conflict with that. So appreciate all the feedback.
Any further member discussion? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Scott, for your work on this bill. And I know we have other bills, and I don't want to take a lot of time, but I just want to put some of my concerns on the record. And we've talked about some of this. I actually think this bill gives too much to big tech. Because I'm concerned about these items that are considered administrative or supplementary support. Because as I've told you, you know, when somebody goes to a therapist, the fact that they made an appointment with a therapist also should be private. And if they're using some kind of scheduling system, I'm concerned about where that data goes, that, you know, everybody's going to know that they made an appointment to see this therapist that they're seeing. So I'm concerned about that if we're allowing AI to be used for that purpose. So I don't think they should be using it at all, quite frankly, and have some more guardrails around how the data, or at the very least, have some guardrails around how that data is used. The other thing I just want to point out is that in the amendments, I think, that were made in the Health Committee about sort of the protections around using a chat box for some of the, maybe on your website when people come to make an appointment or something, they could be interacting with a chat box. And it has here that the chat box, this is like on line three, starting on around 3.31, if the client communicates certain things to the chat box, and the chat box is supposed to respond by saying it is not a human and you're supposed to go do something else, but ironically, that requires the chat box to analyze what that person is putting in that could be, you know, a mental health diagnosis or condition, thoughts of self-harm or harm to others, symptoms, et cetera. So there's already, we're using the chat box to talk to people who may be distressed and relying on it to do the right thing right here in the bill. So I would sure like to get rid of that. And then finally, subdivision 6, I heard something about this maybe being worked on a little bit, but I don't know why. Maybe it's just worded wrong. The Attorney General may enforce this section against an individual other than a licensed professional. I get that. Let that be handled by the boards. But a corporation or an entity. So I think we do want the Attorney General to have, so I think maybe it just isn't worded correctly and you're working on that, but those are my concerns. So, but I do appreciate the bill. I think we should make it as strong as we possibly can.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you for those really constructive suggestions. And I will start with the last thing first. I think the first piece on enforcement was that the boards could take action on individual therapists that were in violation. The enforcement with the Attorney General is for the AI itself, if it's found to be in violation. But certainly we're happy to work on tightening that language up to get it satisfactory. And the other issues, I completely understand your concerns, and if it was my, we're trying to get as much collaboration in this bill as we can, and if it was up to me, we'd just put the X on it. But anyway, we're trying to work collaboratively with a lot of entities, and some of the larger counseling and therapy groups out there are already using some AI in limited ways. And so we want to make sure that we're not causing problems for them and that at the same time, we don't want them to cross certain lines, right? So I appreciate all the constructive suggestions here today in the committee. And I don't know if either one of my testifiers have anything. Looks like Dr. Gerarder might have a comment.
So in subsection 6, I complete, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. Section 6, you hit exactly what happened to us, which is we started this bill with AI chatbots being banned from doing anything and being keyed to if language came up, they had to stop the interaction and ban the interaction from continuing. And in the process of continuing to take feedback from other people, language keeps getting added, and then it goes to being drafted, and the language changes again. And so I agree that the language needs to be tightened up, and the restrictions on the corporation's use of AI in any way, and they should have a limitation as soon as those languages come up, and not just about suicide, as was requested by TechNet, but any kind of depression or anxiety, because someone who wants to commit suicide, they aren't going to say, "I'm going to commit suicide." Do you know that men commit suicide a lot more, but also their families are the most surprised because they don't say, "I'm feeling bad." They don't say, "I'm considering suicide." And so having a line of that the line is they're talking about suicide is a line that is just never going to be crossed. And so I am certainly going to be working to change the language and tighten that up.
And I might add something, Chair, members. If it were up to us, we would prohibit the use of any chatbot companions or any type of chatbot activity, whether it's considered to be a static chatbot that's referring you to resources or anything like that. From our perspective, the wider the net we can do to prohibit the use of chatbots in any type of therapeutic setting, whether it's referral or active therapy. And I want to be clear, we are not Luddites here. Technology has a place, and eventually it will evolve and it will improve, and perhaps sometime in the future, this will be an incredibly powerful interventional tool. But that time is not now. We're not even close to that yet. And so the stronger the protections you can make to protect young people and vulnerable adults from chatbot activity is something we would readily endorse. And so we think this is a good bill from the perspective of the work that it focuses on the chatbot prohibition, and would encourage your continued support in working with the author to continue to strengthen it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Scott renews the motion that House File 3893, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails, and House File 3893 is on its way to Commerce. Members, we are running very low on time. We are going to move to House File 4057. Which is the reviser bill that was just passed around to members. And Chair Scott, would you like to speak to your bill?
Sure thing. Hi.
Chair Scott.
You said 4075?
4057. My apologies.
Oh, man, am I confused.
House File 4057. I will move that before the committee and recommend that it be passed and placed on the general register.
Members, this is the revisor's bill, and I encourage your support.
Oh, very well. Sorry. Is there any member discussion on the bill? I believe that there's a testifier as well. Go ahead and say your name and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Case. I'm here on behalf of the Revisor's Office, and as Chair Scott said, this is our annual Revisor's Bill making technical corrections to the laws and statutes.
Very well. Is there any member discussion on the bill, Representative Feist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a very important question. On page 27, line 27.21, I would just like to understand your thinking behind having the number one become the Roman numeral one. That seems like a very big change. I just want to make sure we're thinking it through. And it looks like the number two is replaced with Roman numeral two and on. Seems like a big deal.
Tesfar, you can respond to that.
Page 27. Chair Scott. Representative Feist, could you give the page and line again?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just being funny, but also, okay. I was also appreciating the level of detail that goes into just making sure our laws are put together with care. So I was mostly being grateful, but also being goofy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your sense of humor there.
Any further member discussion? Chair Scott, any closing comments?
I would encourage your support.
Seeing no further discussion, Chair Scott renews the motion that House File 4057 be recommended to pass and place on the General Register. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 4057 is on its way to the General Register. All right, we're going to try to sneak one more in here. House File 4293. I will move that House File 4293 come before the committee, and the plan is to lay the bill over. Chair Scott, please explain your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just draw members' attention to page 3 of the bill where the new language exists. And read it. I'm just going to read it in context with the rest or the remainder of that sentence. And keep in mind that the pages before this are the best interest factors of the child, and there is a factor here that talks about whether the parents are able to get along in order to, and that's one of the factors to consider. And then this goes deeper into that. And so current law says disagreement alone over whether to grant sole or joint custody does not constitute an inability of parents to cooperate in the rearing of their children as referenced in paragraph A, clause 12. So this language is just adding disagreement alone over the amount of parenting time schedule, or whether to grant sole or joint custody does not constitute an inability of parents to cooperate, et cetera. And what I'm maintaining here is those two clauses, the current one in current law and the one that I'm attempting to add here to this statute, are very similar in nature. And in most cases, those things, if there's sticking point on one, there's probably a sticking point on the other. But what we are saying is that alone should not constitute the reasoning for not allowing should not be factored in the parenting time discussion. So I do have one testifier this morning, Mr. Chair.
Will the testifier please come to the table, state your name, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Josh Friesen, and I'm a father from Woodbury, Minnesota. During my custody case, my goal was simple. I wanted to be present in my children's life, not just occasionally, but consistently as their father. So I asked for more parenting time. But because I disagreed with a minimum parenting schedule of about 25%, which would have made me a limited presence in my children's lives, and advocated for a more equal involvement, I was labeled uncooperative and high conflict. That label changed everything. From that point on, my efforts to be involved weren't seen as responsible parenting. They were seen as conflict. And in my situation, that led to significantly less time with my children and long stretches where maintaining a consistent day-to-day relationship became very difficult. What became clear to me is this. If I stayed quiet, if I had accepted less time and a smaller role in my children's lives, I likely would not have been labeled high conflict. But speaking up to be a present father came at a cost. And that's the problem. Advocating for your children should not work against you. At that same time, even normal, responsible behavior can be interpreted in a negative way. In my case, maintaining full-time employment something most would consider part of being a stable and responsible parent, was actually interpreted as a lack of involvement. That kind of interpretation makes it even harder for a parent to be seen clearly when they are genuinely trying to provide and stay present. Even when I followed the process and requested a parenting time evaluation, a neutral third party, which indicated that a more equal level of involvement would be appropriate, that was not reflected in the final outcome. And the earlier label continued to shape how I was viewed. And when one parent is given primary control, with the other is labeled high conflict, it becomes even harder to maintain a balanced and meaningful relationship with your children. In my situation, that imbalance also creates instability for my kids. Over a relatively short period of time, they experience multiple moves and changes in schools, making it difficult to maintain consistency in their daily lives. At that same time, I have remained in one location and worked to provide a stable, consistent environment for them.
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up as quick as you possibly can.
Yes, sir. But without meaningful parenting time, even a stable parent is limited in their ability to provide that consistency, and that's what concerns me most, because this isn't just about parents, it's about children. Children need stability, they need routine, they need both parents actively involved in their lives, especially after separation, not less. When asking for equal involvement can be interpreted as conflict, it creates a system where staying silent may feel safer than speaking up. I don't believe that serves children well. Because at the end of the day, this isn't about winning or losing in court. It's about whether our children are given the opportunity to have both parents fully present in their lives. I respectfully ask you to support HF 4923 so that parents who are trying to stay involved in their children's lives are not disadvantaged for doing so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And we are running over time at this point. This is obviously a very powerful and important topic. Unfortunately, we're going to forgo member discussion until the bill is brought back up at a future date. The bill 4293 is being laid over. And then our last order of business for the day is just going to be a quick overview of House File 4075. I believe Mr. Dibble is going to explain that to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. House File 4075 is a collaborative bill between myself and Chair Moeller, and it has to do with a 2015 bill that became law that said that if you go through the court process and you are found guilty of domestic violence and the courts order you to turn over your firearms, that you need to turn over your firearms. And we found out that in less than 2% of the cases were those firearms, was that being followed up, those orders were being followed up on. So we have worked with some stakeholders over the last several weeks here. And I ask Mr. Dibble from House Research just to run through what we've come up with here.
Very well. And just so members know, we're not going to be taking this bill up for a vote today. We're just getting this information from nonpartisan. Go ahead, state your name and
describe the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jeff Diebel from House Research. We're working off the DE2 amendment to House File 4075. I'll try to move through it as quickly and concisely as possible. Many of the changes are duplicative because what the overall structure of the bill is to consolidate provisions in domestic violence cases where an offender or a respondent in a petition case is ordered by the court to surrender their firearms. And those provisions are sprinkled throughout our statutes right now. They largely track each other, but there are differences. And so this effort is to put all of those provisions in one section in Chapter 518B. So beginning in Section 1, Sections 1 and 2 deal with CHIPS cases where there's a request for a petition in CHIPS. And on page 2, you'll see that it directs the applicant to identify if they know where a respondent's firearms are so that the court is aware of that, their whereabouts, and if they are surrendered, then they can be helped them identify. Moving on to pages 3 and 4 and 5, This is also part of CHIPS, but this is where we're taking the language out of existing statute and we're recodifying it subsequent section in the bill. It also, the new language on page 4 talks about if you are ordered to surrender your firearms in one of these cases, you also are ordered to surrender your permits to carry and your permits to purchase. Moving forward to the page 6, this is, again, about the OFP petition, same with the CHIPS, where you're directed to tell the court if you know about the respondent's firearms. And then jumping forward to pages 9, 10, and 11, this is almost identical language to what we saw in the CHIPS case. It mirrors that for the order for protection statute, again, telling the respondent that if you have permits to carry and you're ordered to surrender your firearms, you must surrender those as well. And then directing the practitioners to the new section in 518B. Moving forward to the section 5, on page 14 at the bottom, you'll see where current statute on occasion refers just to a pistol or to a particular firearm that was used in a case. And in this case, the court would be ordering the person to not have possession of any firearm. So this would just clarify that language to say that not only are you ineligible to have that pistol or the designated firearm, you're ineligible to have any firearm at that point. Moving on to section 6 on page 15, this is the substance, probably the meat of the bill. This is in, when we talk about transfer of firearms in certain domestic violence cases. And I just want to highlight a few of the provisions in here. It does provide for transfer to an FFL, a federal firearms license holder, law enforcement, or a third party that it doesn't live with the respondent or the defendant. It again, much of this language is already in statute. I'll try to highlight where it deviates from that. On page 16, there is a paragraph C, that the third party transfer is, as drafted here, would need to take place at a law enforcement agency and either supervised by a peace officer or conducted in a space where there's a video camera. I think this is commonly used for Craigslist transfers so that people can have some semblance of security when transferring things. So the expectation would be that these transfers would be held there and then video recorded by the law enforcement's cameras. Moving down, you've got the paragraph D talks about the law enforcement and dealer requirements and responsibilities. Paragraph E talks about the return of firearms for those that are temporarily transferred to dealers and law enforcement. And then paragraph F grants immunity to law enforcement for the storage and handling of the firearms. Moving on to page 17, this is the proof of transfer process. This is largely the same as it is in current law, where the respondent is expected to complete a proof of transfer and return that to the court, acknowledging that they've transferred any firearms they have. Paragraph C under subdivision 3 is the third-party affidavit. So if I transfer a firearm to a third party, they need to acknowledge receipt of the firearm and that they are under a legal obligation not to allow the person to have access to those firearms. There's also a provision for allowing for those who don't own firearms to declare that they do not possess any firearms and submitting that to the court. Moving on to page 18, there is a the duty to file all documents rests with the respondent or the defendant, and then it also reiterates that law enforcement, county attorney, city attorney, as well as household members can still seek an ERPO if they, even if this provision is activated. Section 4 is a new provision that addresses compliance hearings. This would be required to be held by a court after they order a person to surrender their firearms within 10 business days of issuing that order. They would ask the respondent or defendant to come back to the court and explain that they've complied with the transfer order. This has built-in protections to protect the respondent or defendant's rights against self-incrimination. And the goal is there to get them, encourage them to comply without having to subject them to legal jeopardy for complying with the order. And then I think we can you can quickly move through. The remaining provisions are duplicative of what was in the earlier part of the bill. It's just conforming changes in the domestic assault harassment statute and then pretrial release for violent offenders. But they all comply with, or they're consistent with what was we discussed in the CHIPS and OFP provisions.
Thank you for that description. And for those members remaining, thank you for your indulgence. The meeting is adjourned.